following interview is brought to you by the Mile High Sanity Project. You're in it.
We're with Michael Shermer. He is the founding publisher of Skeptic Magazine and the executive director of the Skeptic Society. He's also an adjunct professor at Claremont Graduate University. He is the author of quite a few books and lectures frequently on matters of skepticism, critical thinking, and welcome. We're the Mile High Sanity Project. Thanks for meeting with us.
Thanks for having me.
So we're going to talk to you about your new book, The Believing Brain, From Ghosts and Gods to Politics and Conspiracies, how we construct beliefs and reinforce them as truths. Our first question is, what motivated you to write this particular book?
Well, my first book was Why People Believe Weird Things. And so in this book, I want to look at why people believe things, period, full stop. And that, in fact, weird things are just a subset of things, and we have to believe things. And we're not very good at discriminating between true things and false things. So our propensity to believe everything is what gets us into trouble. So that is really the basis of magical thinking and superstition, which we will always have with us, like the poor, I guess, because it's just built into the system. And so I start off with the hypothetical thought experiment. If you're a hominid on the plains of Africa 3.5 million years ago and your name is Lucy, and you hear a rustle in the grass, is it a dangerous predator or is it just the wind? So if you assume that the rustle in the grass is a dangerous predator, turns out it's just the wind, you've made an error in cognition, a type 1 error, a false positive. You thought the pattern was real, and it isn't. But no harm. You just become careful and cautious and move around that noise. If you, on the other hand, think the rustle in the grass is just the wind, turns out it's a dangerous predator, you're lunch. Congratulations, you've just been given a Darwin Award for taking yourself out of the gene pool. So I argue there's a natural selection, an evolution of the propensity to assume that most rustles in the grass are dangerous predators and not the wind. And that is then the basis for superstition and magical thinking. But for all thinking, this is called learning. When you figure out a pattern, A is connected to B and B is connected to C and so forth, that's called learning. And all organisms do it, from C. elegans to H. sapiens. And without that, we would not be able to survive, because the environment's always changing, it's complex, and our genome is not complicated enough to hold that much information. So we have to learn, but it's not perfect. We don't have a baloney detection kit in our brain that tells us precisely what the difference is between true and false patterns. So The Believing Brain is actually a pro-science book, even though I argue that our perception of reality is completely dependent on our beliefs. I call that belief-dependent realism. Right. In fact, science is our savior to get us out of that trap.
I gotcha. So our belief acceptance radar is kind of set too high, and there's a good reason for that, but we've kind of moved past that as well.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. The filter that most of us have is a little too wide open for seeing patterns as real. On the other hand, you don't want it ratcheted down too much where you never see any new patterns, then you don't learn anything new.
Right.
And you make no new discoveries, and there's no new art or music or creative genius. That's not good either. So, I mean, if you think about it, this process of patternicity I'm talking about here, the tendency to see meaningful patterns in both meaningful and meaningless noise, when it becomes meaningful, like a scientific discovery, that's important. They give Nobel Prizes for that.
Right.
And artists and creative geniuses and musicians and so on, they find new patterns that no one else has seen. And that's also good. But if you see everything as a pattern, then you're paranoid. You're paranoid schizophrenic, maybe. That's not good.
Mm-hmm.
And if you believe every wacky idea, you accept Bigfoot and Loch Ness Monster and aliens and ESP and psychics and ghosts and the whole ball of wax. And by the way, the correlation showed that people that tick the one box tick most of the boxes.
Sure.
That then your filter is too wide open. You just accept everything.
Got it. Is there a general insight that you hope readers will gain from the book, other than this kind of summary that we've already done? Is there something that you hope, by the time the person's done with the book, a message that they will get?
Yeah, one message is that, particularly in areas of politics, economics, religion, that are pretty controversial, that we recognize that the people who hold these beliefs A, really do believe them, and B, really do have evidence for them. Now, they may not really be objective evidence, but mm-hmm. in their mind, it is, because the thesis of the believing brain is that we start off with our beliefs first and then find evidence to fit that second. The beliefs come first due to a whole host of psychological, social, cultural factors. We were born that way, our parents raised us that way, our culture made us that way, peer groups, influence, mentors, teachers, and so on, push us in various directions. And then our rational brain engages in the process of lawyering the data to fit the belief and make it seem true.
Rationalizations.
And yeah. So, how can those creations actually believe this? Or do those Holocaust deniers really believe this? Mm-hmm. Yeah, they really do, and they really think they have the evidence. Climate skeptics, whoever. And so there's a certain amount of, I think, understanding that helps us lead to shifting people's worldviews. I mean, this is the study of influence. How do we shift people's perspective on things? Marketing people do this already. Mm-hmm. The political people are trying to figure this out. How do we shift the undecided voters to the left or the right? That's what the battle for American politics is for the undecided voter. And in a way, that's our battle, the skeptics, sure. atheists, humanists. You know, how do we get people to quit believing in invisible men in the sky and mysterious forces in the paranormal? How do these things are not true, so we have right. to shift them. But you're not going to do it by having better arguments alone. There has to be something else. And that's sort of the takeaway message. Like in the chapter on politics, I'm trying to pull back and look at the left and the right from a more objective perspective. What mm-hmm. is it that the right believes that the left doesn't seem to get, and vice versa? And why do they believe that? So that, I think, hopefully leads to understanding.
I got it. A lot of these questions are overlapping with others, but we'll work our way through it. So you talk a great deal about our tendency towards pattern seeking, what you're saying, patternicity. Is that a word that you've coined? I coined it.
And I don't mean it just as a different word than, say, pareidolia. Here, because I'm not just talking about patterns that aren't true. I'm talking about all patterns.
Sure.
This is what we do. I mean, a scientist who's trying to construct a climate model that's super complex with lots of patterns of data, That's a kind of pattern. He thinks he's found a pattern. Mm-hmm. Maybe he has. Maybe he hasn't. How do we know? Right? How do we know which patterns are true or not? If we just go by our hunches and instincts, we wouldn't believe in global warming. You don't see it. It doesn't seem like it's happening. Yeah. It was cold the other day. What are you talking about?
Right.
Global warming. You know, so our brains are just not geared for 1,000-year trends. That's why people have a hard time with evolution. In addition to their perceived religious threats by science, sure. there's something else going on. That is, we don't see it happening. So, I mean, it's like quantum physics. It's just so weird. I don't see any of that. It's not intuitive. I don't grasp it. I just take the word of my colleagues up for that and the experiments that they run. But I don't really understand the mathematics of it. String theory, you know. String theory is a nice example of a pattern. Maybe it's real. Maybe it's not. Some people think it is. Some people think it isn't. There's no evidence for it yet. So what do we do with that?
Yeah. Not much.
Not much, right.
Yeah.
So that's what I mean by patternicity. It's a larger thinking process. Same thing with agenticity, the tendency to infuse those patterns with intentional agency. We do this a lot,
right?
Like conspiracies and ghosts and gods and demons and angels and aliens, you know, and that sort of thing, that there's some hidden force at work there.
A form of anthropomorphism, basically.
Yeah, I think so.
Got it. I think the question that we had was just how essential are these tendencies in our formation of beliefs? It sounds to me like you're saying that they're absolutely essential. They're foundational to all our beliefs.
Yeah, it's everything, right. So instead of thinking, how can we get rid of superstitions, we're not. We just have to work around them. Mm-hmm. My analogy with politics is we all recognize that the spread of liberal democracy is a good thing in breaking up power. And not letting have any one person or entity have too much power is a good thing. And the reason we say that we have to be eternally vigilant about that is because we realize that by nature people want power. Mm-hmm. And so that will never go away. We can't change human nature. We can't change the way the brain is wired. People are always going to want power. And so we have to have a system set up to prevent that from happening. So the ultimate solution to the people believing in gods that are dangerous is to make them not dangerous. Mm-hmm. Don't let them have power. Then it doesn't really matter what wacky ideas they believe, as long as they can't bother me or hurt me. Now, it'd be nice if the whole world were rational.
Right.
But what I'm saying is that's not going to happen. We're not going to talk everybody on the planet out of believing in God. I think that's part of it. That's part of the package.
We're pretty far from that when you can't even elect anyone in the United States that doesn't, you know, profess being religious.
Yeah, I know. It's disturbing. On the other hand, I guess if you take the bigger picture, say the last 500 years, things have gotten better.
Sure.
But I don't think that has to do with the spread of science so much as the spread of democracy and other social systems that empower people so that they need religion less. Like Northern Europeans are less religious. No one's quite sure why. There's much debate about this, but probably has something to do with the fact that their governments do what religions do.
Right.
You know, they take care of the poor, man the soup kitchens, that sort of thing. So atheists forget about this. They still think of religion based on a belief in the invisible guy in the sky. That's really sort of secondary.
Right.
What it's doing something else socially that's really important that science is not doing. And so again, social capital is what the sociologists call that. Right. You know, it brings people together, makes them feel better. They like singing, they like working towards some cause, social justice, helping the poor, that sort of thing. That's a good thing.
Yeah.
But if governments do it, then religions don't have to do it. And maybe that's why all the Northern European countries like Sweden and Denmark and so on, they're like 80% atheists. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. So this could actually happen, but not probably in our lifetime.
Right.
But, you know, it's something we can work toward.
That kind of thing is definitely something that the quote-unquote atheist community is not very good at. It's not very good at, being supportive of each other, getting, you know, positively involved in each other's lives. I'm not saying the atheist community doesn't do it at all. It's just not nearly as good at it as religions are.
I think by temperament, a lot of atheists tend to be independent thinkers. And so it's like, why won't libertarians... why can't they be a big political party? Because by definition, they hate big political parties.
It's antithetical.
And they want to be left alone. They're anti-authoritarians.
Yeah.
So, of course, they're not going to be big. Atheists are the same way.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I actually think it may be the same temperament. A lot of libertarians are atheists. Hmm. Now, most atheists are liberal, not libertarian. But there's a bigger group of libertarians in the atheist movement than other places in society.
That makes sense. And just a general, desire to not be told what to think or do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Trying to stick to the list. Let's see. An understanding of how we perceive the world and subsequently form opinions about reality is obviously essential to scientists and their work. But what is the benefit to the average non-scientist in understanding these concepts? So what's the public appeal of... having a stronger critical mind.
Right. Well, the obvious direct technological spinoffs is everything, the internet and iPhones and our planes and cars and so on. That's a direct result of scientific discoveries. The technologies couldn't happen without the discoveries of the principles behind them. And everybody gets that. What makes them nervous is if your worldview, the scientific worldview, bumps up against other beliefs, particularly religious faith or their economic ideologies or their political beliefs, then that starts to make them nervous. Now, so part of our job, I think, as marketers of reason is to try to say this is only going to add to the package. This is going to be good. Mm-hmm. And it isn't going to take anything away from you. Just push the positive and stay away from the negative aspects of it. Mm-hmm. Don't give up anything. Just go for reason and science and support it. And then what actually happens, I think, is that religious faiths and beliefs fall into disuse quietly. They just sort of blend into the background.
Sure.
Because it's hard for people to give it up overtly, especially if they have social capital tied to it. So
exactly.
If you say, well... you mean I have to get to believe in this Darwin stuff? I have to quit going to church and all my friends go there and I don't get to be friends with them anymore. Mm-hmm. My family's going to, ostracize me. Forget it. I don't really care about the science stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't see any connection with that, with the technology. It's down the line. But in general, I think we can make a really good argument that for the last 500 years or so, most of the major advances everywhere in every aspect of life are the result of reason and science. Rationality, all of it. And so we should keep pushing that because that's the only hope we have.
Right. But of course, for the general public, they're not involved in making these transitions from science to technology. Or if they are, it might be in a fairly minor role that they'll take advantage of it. But as far as in their personal lives, I'm not sure what's in it for them.
Yeah, right. That's a slightly harder sell, isn't it? You know, I mean, so watching the Gee Whiz shows on the Science Network and the Fur, Fen, and Feather shows on the Nature Channels and all that. I mean, it's sort of fun and interesting for the average person. I am encouraged by the market success of so many of these channels and networks that they're still around. A&E, Discovery Channel, Science Channel, History Channel, Learning Channel. That must mean there's a market for it, although admittedly a lot of them do a lot of the UFO conspiracy stuff and Nostradamus and all that as a sell.
Sadly.
Yeah, and they do that because I guess it gets good ratings. Yeah. So they're, right, what's in it for them? Well, you know, it's like trying to sell the public on why we should build the particle accelerator or whatever. Right.
It's hard.
It's hard, yeah, but you know, because we want to know. That's the nature that you have to sort of sell it from the big, because we're curious. We want to know, because it's there. We like the challenge. We want to know what the world's really like. And I think so.
Yeah. I think in general, there are a lot of opportunities to get taken in common everyday life, and having a general skepticism does help with that. I think that if a person is generally skeptical of their own ideas, they're also going to be in a healthy way skeptical of possibly getting taken advantage of. Do you think that there's a practical application?
There's a good practical thing. Yeah, not to get suckered in by the Bernie Madoffs.
Sure.
If you're a critical thinker, you're less likely to fall for that sort of thing. Yeah, I mean, all of economics is based on the ability to reason critically about particular claims, you know, what's the proper tax rate and that sort of thing.
Right.
Because people are going to argue for it, even though probably they're really making decisions on emotional reasons and their ideological beliefs. But still, they're going to make the argument. So as informed voters, we need to know how to think about those kinds of claims. I mean, there's hardly a newspaper article you can read that doesn't cite some kind of statistics or graphs or something. You have to be able to read that. Mm-hmm. That's why the SAT has those kinds of questions on it. They want to know if you can read a graph and understand what it means.
Right, right.
That's important for, well, I mean, if I was a politician and, you know, America is way down the list on reading and math and science, it's incredibly discouraging. Mm-hmm. How far behind we are. It's terrible. It's pathetic. It's embarrassing. You know, so we need to do something about that.
Yeah, and we're buying our fair share of homeopathic remedies and going to, you know, quote unquote witch doctors. Sure. All right. Still trying to stick to the, because I could chit chat with you for a long time. Let's see. Of course, you're going to have countless sympathetic readers from the skeptic community and from the general public as well. But what influence, if any, do you think or hope your book might have on conspiracy theorists themselves, ghost hunters, snake oil peddlers, and the like? I guess, and part of my view of this question is it even likely that they will read your book?
Well, I hope so. But right? Of course, what I'm saying in the book is that people only filter in information that supports what they already believe. So somebody that doesn't believe what I believe is less likely to read my book, therefore proving my point, which is discouraging because I'd rather than read the book.
Bit of a paradox.
Yeah, I mean, it is a bit of a paradox. So I think, well, by taking a bigger picture to understand how the brain works, just like I'm not trying to debunk people's beliefs. I'm trying to understand how the brain works. Mm-hmm. Aren't you interested in understanding how the brain works?
Sure.
Of course. Aren't you interested in the neuroscience of beliefs? Of course I am. Okay, then read my book.
Right.
Now, at the end of it, if you come to the conclusion that, you know what, all that stuff about ESP probably isn't true, okay, that's good. Mm-hmm. So admittedly, full frontal assault on somebody's beliefs is not likely to change them. But again, with the political analogy, we're after the undecided voters. People are not committed behaviorally to their beliefs. And so we can swing them over and then maybe quietly shift some of the others over by making it okay not to believe, that it's, you know, that it's acceptable not to believe.
Right.
You have to make it more positive, I think. So I try to do that. By taking a bigger picture, like in the chapter on politics, it's not that the left is right and the right is wrong, you know, or vice versa. These are just different moral values that the left and right emphasize. So let's think about it. Maybe you're actually a little bit on the other side more than you thought you were. Mm-hmm. Think about that, mm-hmm. And then that makes you more tolerant of other people.
Right.
And tolerance is a good thing because we're so tribal, and tribalism has its dark side. I think tolerance is another goal of that we should have.
Let's see. In the book, you point out that across countries and decades, the majority of people hold some form of belief in the supernatural. Why do you think that phenomena specifically is so ubiquitous? You commented on this in the beginning. I'm not sure if there's...
Yeah, I think it's that, you know, that we impose agency and intentional agency on things. It's that agenticity. It's the intentional stance, as Dennett calls it. It's there's lots of ways to come at it. Essentialism, sometimes it's called, that we believe that things have an essence to them. And from there, an essence is if you link that to dualism, then the essence becomes a non-material substance, a spiritual substance, a soul, that kind of thing. And so I have a whole chapter on that with like the research by Paul Bloom and Bruce Hood and others. Like, would you wear a Hitler sweater? Almost everybody goes, ugh, no. Mm-hmm. Why not? Well, you know, it's evil.
Right.
You know, how about Mr. Rogers' cardigan sweater? Oh, yeah, that'd be nice, you know. And one of the guys, I forget which one, it might have been Bruce Hood, who put Brad Pitt's sweater up for sale on eBay. Mm-hmm. Would you buy it? And what would you pay for it? Washed or unwashed? You know, and the unwashed version gets a higher price, you know, because it's like, oh, the essence of Brad Pitt is coming with the sweater. Sure. Well, in a way it is, if it's not washed, because there's probably sweat.
Right.
And we know from the T-shirt, the sweaty T-shirt test with the, you know, women given T-shirts, you know, right. And they pick one. All they're asked is, would you want to date the guy that wore this shirt, right? And they end up picking one that has a certain kind of odor that matches their genetics that would generate that kind of odor, and therefore they're sort of by proxy with the T-shirt matching somebody physically that would be good for them. Mm-hmm. And people that are in love often talk about the scent of their lover and how much they like that. And so there's probably actually something biological to that. And on the negative side, disgust is often associated with bad things, you know, bodily excrements and things like this that carry disease.
Sure.
Probably good to avoid those. So the disgust emotion, or the sort of feel-good emotion, emotions are proxies for behavior. They drive behavior, and genetics codes for these things. And so... that's a small step from that kind of essence, which is actually biological, to a dualistic essence that goes with the person. After the person dies, it continues on into the afterlife, the soul. So in a way, a soul is sort of a essence of a person in a dualistic way that becomes non-physical, and they're still there.
Hmm. So kind of a correlation between non-verbal communication and... non-rational beliefs. I mean, rational beliefs are going to appear to be linguistic. So we all have form beliefs in ways that are, and legitimately, not in rational means per se. And so you're drawing a correlation to that and things that are irrational.
Yep. That's right.
I'm going to have to think about that for a
little while. So the whole basis of the afterlife, that's a dualistic, essentialistic form of agenticity. I'm my own agent, my own intentional agent is carrying on non-physically, non-corporeally, in my essence, my dualistic essence, into the far future. Right. That's the afterlife. And so, of course, I have to deal with the ontological questions. Are any of these things real? Are there gods? Is there an afterlife? Are there aliens? I do address those questions. So the book's a little bit longer because of that, because I'm a psychologist interested in why people believe, but I also want to know, are these things actually true or not?
Sure.
And inquiring minds want to know, right? We're the skeptics. We want to know, damn it. So no, I don't think so. There's no God. There's no afterlife. Unless Ray Kurzweil is right and we can reach the singularity where computers are large enough that we can download our memories, our essence, our pattern of our being into the computer, and that can carry on into the far future. Well, okay, I think he's probably a long ways. We're a long ways off from that. I think he's off on his... projections, but that's possible. So, but that I like that story because it at least gets people to think about what a soul can possibly be. I mean, I'm willing to agree there could be a soul in the sense of a pattern of information, just like my genome exists. So there must be something like my genome that is in my brain. That's my pattern of neural firings that represents my memories and my personality, and that's who I am. Now, how could we copy that? And you can copy a genome like Kerry Mullis's PCR method with the cheek swab, and then he duplicates the sequence, and that's how you figure out genetic matching and patterns and DNA tests, things like that for CSI type analysis. Well, in principle, you could do that with if you can figure out how memories are stored and figure out what the patterns are, what they represent. It's sort of like, what's the movie where they go into people's dreams? The one with...
Inception?
Yeah, Inception. A little bit like that. You'd have to know what the patterns mean and then replicate them in a computer, and then you could replicate somebody's dreams. Well, in principle, you could do that if you had a big enough computer and you knew how memory was stored.
Sure.
And then it's only a small step, and by small I mean huge, to actually storing it into a computer and replicating it.
Hard drives are cheap.
Absolutely. Well, this is Kurzweil's argument. I have to say it is a compelling thing. I think he's way off. I think 2030. I don't even think 2130. I think maybe 2500. Maybe we'll get there, something like that. Unfortunately, I'm going to be so pissed if all this stuff happens just after I die. It's like, oh, we achieved immortality just after you died.
You won't know, so you won't be angry.
I won't know. Yeah. See, I kind of feel like I would know. So I'd be somewhere else, but that's my own brain tricking me because I know I won't be.
Yeah. Of course, these discussions about Kurzweil, which I'm not terribly familiar with, but I don't think that those would be the kinds of souls or essences that are, you know, a religious person would accept the definitions of those words.
I know. Why is that now? So what are they thinking is going to happen? That, I mean, they have different versions of it, but that we'll be resurrected in heaven, right? And then some of them think physical resurrection, other things just spiritual resurrection. So when they say physical resurrection, I always ask, at what age?
Sure.
Right? Because, you know, I'm 56 and I'm starting to get some aches and pains. I think I wouldn't want to be resurrected at 56.
You're starting just now. I'm 43 and I'm
thinking maybe 36, maybe 26 might be good. But 26, maybe I'm not fully developed yet. 29, I'm told. That some theologian told me they figured this out. Age 29 is the perfect age to be resurrected.
I think in the Jewish tradition it was age 30.
Kind
of considered to be fully on. That's your peak.
So, okay, yeah, there you go.
That sounds about right.
Okay, that sounds good to me.
Oh, let's see. I'm trying to make sure that we're going to actually go through these. You also state that, alas, I have come to the conclusion that belief is largely immune to attack by direct educational tools. And we've talked about that here, at least for those who are not ready to hear it. What alternatives do you suppose we have to direct attack? I think you've kind of already answered that. The attitude of the water is fine if you don't want to believe.
Right. That's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I am a believer in education. I think maybe teaching process more than fact. We have to teach science facts for sure, but also the process of how science works, and that it's not some mysterious arcane thing. Everybody already knows how it works. Like, everybody knows that when the FDA approves a drug, it means it went through some clinical trials. And, well, what does that mean? Well, I kind of vaguely are familiar, this control group, experimental group, and the blind. He was in the blind condition, or he was in the placebo condition, or the double blind. You know, they kind of have a sense that there's something going on there to control for things. Mm-hmm. So I think more teaching more of that in a, I think, a fun way is good. Everything we're doing, here's the other way that's new. All this bottom-up social networking. Wait, I'm thinking of the right term for like Facebook and
Social networking.
Social networking, yeah. Right. Podcasts, mm-hmm. You know, all this stuff, Twittering. These are all ways to come at it different ways. So I've been incredibly encouraged by every city I go to. There's a Skeptics in the Pub and you know, a Drinking Atheist Club and a, you know, just a meetup group and all these things. No one organized that. They just happen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's no top down,
right.
Which is good because I don't like doing that. You know, as the head of the Skeptic Society, we just sort of do our thing.
Mm-hmm.
And but this is encouraging in terms of like spreading science and skepticism and critical thinking from the bottom up. That's how it's done. Mm-hmm. We already know that's how the politicos do it. You know, the grassroots movement, the Tea Party movement, and all that stuff. We saw what happened with that. There was no somebody in the White House that said, "Hey, let's do a Tea Party," or on the other side, whatever. You know, they just sort of spontaneously happen.
Mm-hmm. You know, on your earlier point about education and science education, including this general understanding of the processes of science, in some ways, I think that the way we teach science in high school is kind of backwards. We teach specific subjects, and most students don't get a general idea of the scientific method.
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
It seems like it should be the other way around.
I think so. That's what I'm saying, the process of how science works. Now, in science education, circles, that is people that study science education, they have this debate about science fact versus science process.
Right.
I think it's content versus process is what they call it. And I lean more toward the process. Mm-hmm. You know, let's get students involved in how to do this. We just published a paper a couple of issues ago in Skeptic. This professor at some college in Ohio, where in teaching a particular science, they start right off with you actually running experiments, doing what the professor is doing, so you can see if you like it or not. Rather than having 3 or 4 years of classroom where you're just sitting there taking notes to study the subject, do you actually even want to do this?
Right.
And his analogy opening this article is like, imagine taking a tuba class. And the first year you study tuba theory, and then the second year the history of the tuba, and so on and so on. And then finally you go to graduate school and you actually get to play one. You go, you know what? I don't really like playing the tuba.
Nah.
You just wasted all those years. So I actually like that analogy. Just get right in there and do it. And then you can see if science is for you and that it's a really cool process.
Mm-hmm. All right. So there is no magic wand that can be waved to achieve an understanding of critical thinking and appreciation of scientific method in the general public overnight, or even in a single lifetime, which you said in this interview. Do you think that the end is achievable in the long run? And do you think that there are some signs that we're going in the right direction? And, you know, that answer could be globally or here in the United States.
I am encouraged. I think we're getting there. Again, I think as a historian, we take the big perspective from the Enlightenment on. Late Middle Ages to the early modern period and the Enlightenment and to compare to today, it's way better, right? I mean, almost nobody was literate then and no one was educated and everybody was dirt poor. That's why the reincarnation is such a silly story. Everybody comes back as a princess or a king or something.
Or past lives,
Yeah, past lives, right. Yeah. I mean, 99.9% of everybody ever born was a dirt poor farmer.
Yeah.
That's what you're coming back as, you know, if you go back. Anyway, so, I mean, things are so much better that way. I mean, the levels of superstition today are disturbingly high, but only by comparison to the scientific world we live in. In the context, it's actually much better than it used to be. And again, there were zero liberal democracies in 1900. Now there's something like 129 around the world. Even America wasn't a liberal democracy. Women couldn't even vote till 1920. All right, so but we made progress. That's a good analogy. You know, spreading democracy is the right thing because all democracies have education. They all recognize the support of science and technology and education for women and minorities. They all think that's a good thing. And with that comes teaching skepticism, critical thinking, science, and what we do. Mm-hmm. So I think politically that's one thing we can do. And specifically teaching that stuff is, you know, in many different ways, coming at it lots of different angles. You know, there is no one right approach. Is Dawkins the right approach to the God question? Or is, you know, Chris Mooney or me or Sam Harris or what? Yeah, they're all good because there's just lots of different people with lots of different beliefs and it works for some, or other approaches work for others. Just put them all out there.
Sure.
It's all good.
Gotcha. So the scientific community has always had to defend itself from critics. For example, the misleading criticisms of the National Science Foundation funding from Oklahoma Senator Tom Coburn and others, attempts to undermine science education in public schools, such as in Dover, and the offering of degrees in alternative medicine from accredited colleges and universities, and some to which I will not mention right now, I work for. What steps can concerned skeptics take to support and promote critical thinking in our local communities?
Well, I think, again, the grassroots, bottom-up social networking stuff is working. Like what we do is a good model, I think, at public lecture series and bring in skeptics and scientists of all stripes to talk about these things and just invite everybody to come, as well as the meetups and the pubs and things like that. At least there's a community for people to go to. We do get a lot of people that come. They come for the social aspects. It's like they're atheists or whatever, and they don't have a community. And this is what it appeals about religion. It's a community. And it's like, well, where do I go? You come to Caltech on Sunday. We're all meeting. We're going out drinking afterwards. Wow, okay.
Right.
And then next month we're doing this geology trip into the mountains. Wow, okay, I'll go. And more of that. And I, you know, I can't do all that. But, you know, fortunately in every city there are groups like this. Mm-hmm. This is all good.
Yeah.
I mean, tonight's the, what's the Mile High Skeptics tonight?
Where you are going to that. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
that's
yeah. Right. Yes, that's a good thing. More of that's better. Mm-hmm. And that'll just continue to catch on. Look, again, with the political analogy, look how fast the Tea Party came on the scene. Mm-hmm. I mean, in less than a year, they became like a major force.
Yeah.
Wow, how could that be? Well, there it is.
Well, they're unified behind a cause. I think that
yes, you have to have a cause, right? Yeah. So, and we do. We have a really good.
It's starting
cause.
To get clarified.
I think so. Yeah. Let's not focus too much on the no God stuff,
right?
Because that's a no. There's a no in there. Right. We're pro science, reason, rationality, critical thinking.
Let the chips fall where they may.
Yeah.
Sure. Skeptics notoriously have a public image problem, mostly fueled by their portrayal in the media. As someone who has made their fair share of appearances in the media, do you think that your work is represented fairly?
For the most part. I mean, yeah, there are bad interviews where you get edited or whatever that frustrating. That happens occasionally.
We're not going to edit this interview.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it never happens on podcasts because they let you talk. And most radio hosts let you talk, although the AM guys tend not to do that. They like to hear themselves talk. But NPR is good and PBS is good on TV. So there's hit and misses. But for the most part, I think most journalists try to do a good job. And again, we want to focus on the journalists, not the guys you see on Fox News with their programs. That's not journalism.
Right.
Those are like opinion editorials. They have an opinion, and that's why you go there to hear that. You don't listen to Rush Limbaugh to get a fair and balanced, if I can use that phrase,
sure.
Perspective. So yeah, I think it's been fairly good. Mm.
Well, I think you probably do a fairly good job sending your message in a palatable way. You're not an abrasive. I've seen you in interviews, and you're not particularly abrasive. You're not particularly ornery. So,
well, by temperament, I'm not. And besides that, it's not a good strategy. Yeah. I think for the most part. I mean, I think the Hitchens approach, which I really like, he's so much fun to listen to. Yeah. But
maybe he can get away with it because he has that clever British wit.
Yes, I think that helps. Penn Jillette gets away with it because he's funny. Yeah. Dawkins because he's an Oxford Don.
Sure.
I just don't feel like I would do that effectively. Yeah. I just think it's a right approach for some people, and it's well received by some. Mm-hmm. Again, maybe those who are ready to hear it.
Right.
Yeah.
Let's see. Last question. In regards to promoting skepticism, critical thinking, and science education, you've produced a large volume of work and given countless lectures. What effect do you hope your efforts thus far and in the future will ultimately achieve?
Well, we want to change the world, make the world a better place. The way to do that is spreading science and reason and critical thinking. That's my mission. I think I'm just one more stepping stone, just mm-hmm. the next generation. You're the next generation. I'm an old guy now. You guys take over, and you have the
These
mantle is yours.
These guys, maybe not so much.
I mean, Randy's almost, we're losing that generation one by one, and then soon my turn will be. Well, that's okay. That's how it works. So we're all on this together. It's a long path. You know, it's a thousand years before we get there, but we'll get there. Mm-hmm. I do. I'm fairly optimistic about that. But it's again, what the point of the believing brain is that this is an uphill battle in the sense that it's hardwired into our brains to think this other way, not scientifically. Science is counterintuitive, but if we make it more intuitive by just sort of inculcating it into everything we do, that'll help. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so on behalf of the Mile High Sanity Project, I'd like to thank Dr. Michael Shermer for taking the time to visit with us. And if you'd like to learn more about our interview with him and also just check out our other content, go to Mile High Sanity Project at WordPress.com.
Dot WordPress.
We're going to figure that out at some point.
This has been a presentation of the Mile High Sanity Project. There is a good chance that we agree with the views expressed in this interview, but if backed into a corner, we will adamantly refuse to commit ourselves one way or the other.